You're listening to The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, bringing class to trash since 1977.
Everybody, welcome to the GGTMC. We are back and we are live, alive. Yes, we are surviving. It's me, it's Toddy, it's Willie, it's the GGTMC. And everybody's excited. You can hear it.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. We've been working on tubs. We've been shooting paintball guns. We've been doing all kinds of things behind the scenes.
Take that paintball mention however you will.
That's right. That's right. We've been shooting globs, dare bay.
Globs, yeah.
All right, we're back this week, and it's an Arrow-sponsored show. We are doing Scalpel from 1977, directed by John Grismer. And we've now completely covered John Grismer's filmography. And Killer Clowns from Outer Space, 1988, directed by Stephen Kyoto. I think it's how you say their name, Kyoto.
Yes.
But yes. Known for the Kyoto brothers. There's three of them, and they work together. And we'll talk more about that when we get to it. So that is the big show this week. We want to let everybody know the next week we'll be doing, we already know what we're doing. So I want to announce it, right here at the top, at the head of the show here, that we'll be doing the Slumber Party Massacre series 1, 2, 3, next week, that politically correct trilogy. So we'll be doing that next week, with our good friend, Jeremy, he's a good friend of the show. And he's going to come on. So just to kind of give him a little bit of a bump here at the beginning and a week before. We look forward to speaking with him. He's been listening for a while now. And, that'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see if we can get three films in between the three of us.
It's going
to
be airtight.
Sure is. Sure is. Yeah. It'll be interesting. It's a challenge. Everybody has their challenges at the beginning of the year. Like, I'm going to read 50 books. Well, you know, my challenge this week is I'm going to try to watch three films.
That's right.
Because, it's tough to find time nowadays. But that's what we are doing the week after, or next week, I should say. This week, we are doing these two films. I should say today is my daughter's birthday. She is 4 years old today. So we're having a birthday party here at the house today. So if you ever go back and listen to this, darling, I love you. Dad loves you. And I wasn't always stern sometimes or as goofy as I act with you. Sometimes I was just plain goofy. And if you go back and listen to this stuff, I'm sure you and your brother will know that. Someday you'll be like, Dad, you were a little strange. Like, oh, yeah.
A little.
Just a little bit. Yeah. My friends were a little strange as well. It's what brought us all together.
That's right. Well, happy birthday to her. And yes. Those 4 years have gone quick.
Oh, boy. You have
no pictures.
Oh, man.
Poof. It's crazy, man. It's absolutely crazy. So I hope she has a great day. Hope no children you know, break anything or throw up anywhere. And hopefully it's a good day for all.
For those of you who don't have children, and if you have parties at your house with kids, it's stress from the time that weekend starts until that party's over.
Oh, yeah.
It's unbearable. It's just you're putting away things that you don't normally put away because you're like, well, I don't want this to get broken.
You're cleaning in nooks and crannies you don't normally clean.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, you find things that you're like, whoa, man, who tried to eat this? It's just, you know, it's just one of those things. But, you know, you do it because you love your kids and you want them to remember. You know, I don't, for me growing up, I had birthday parties. But eventually they kind of died off. And I don't remember much about my birthday parties, really, as a grown-up. I remember a few of them, but I don't remember much. So, you know, I think a lot of us try to always make things memorable for our kids. So, Trey, we go overboard, just like a lot of parents do. So,
yeah, there's worse things that you can do than, you know, go a little overboard for your kids. Yeah. That's for sure.
I love you, baby. Happy 4th birthday. All right, let's get into what we've been watching. Totter, what have you been up to? How many films outside of 2 did you watch this week?
A couple.
There you go. 2 more.
I actually had some free time for once.
Yeah.
So I watched the third part of the Battles Without Honor and Humanity series, Proxy War. And yeah, this one is even more convoluted than the previous two.
I'm not gonna lie. Will and I talked about it at one point covering this whole series.
Well, the thing is that they tend to be very similar.
Yeah.
There's not much distinction between them outside of here and there.
Yeah, I'm intimidated by the idea of covering all those in one show.
Well, it's what, 5 movies? So.
Yeah, it'd have to probably be 2 shows, but I'd still be intimidated. I'm not gonna lie to you. It's,
oh god,
those things are usually so dense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And this one is no exception, although it's still great. And, you know, Bunta Sugawara really stands out. He's one of those, it's one of those things where I'm watching and I'm like, so he's basically supposed to be the central character, but at the same time, he tends to not be on screen for long stretches. And I don't know if that's because of just, you know, production scheduling or the way that they worked up the story or what, but it is always a joy seeing him get on screen and go. And he does that enough here. So, yeah, I'm still liking the series. I'm still liking it a lot. Fukusaku's really bringing the thunder. And I'm enjoying that thunder from down under.
We should say that is the Arrow release, right, you're talking about. So.
Yes.
Yes, yeah. So even in your spare time, you're sponsored by Arrow.
I know, right? I sponsored Arrow on that one. I went back because I was like, I haven't seen a shitty 90s slasher movie in a long time. So I watched I Know What You Did Last Summer. And it is, it's okay.
I bet that's dated.
Oh, you think?
Yeah. Man.
I bet that is. I'd be interested to go back and look at some of those 90s slashers, but I haven't, you know, I haven't had that, you know, that lust like you did. But
yeah.
I remember that being okay.
Yeah, that's all it
that's
is.
That's where I would recall it, too.
Yeah.
That's all it is okay. I mean, aside from getting to ogle Love Hewitt.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's really not a ton more to really recommend it. Ryan, what's his name? Ryan Felipe? Yeah.
Felipe. He's an obnoxious character in that film, if I remember right.
He is a total douche. to the point that, you know, he's that guy that you're waiting for him to get knocked off.
Yeah.
and then the big reveal is just kind of like, oh, okay. So there's that.
Yeah.
And then I watched Lopez's. What's that?
They only made 2 of those, right? I Know What You Did, and I Still Know What You Did. I don't think they made a third one.
I know I'm not interested in anything else.
Todd doesn't care what you still did last summer.
I don't.
I still know what you did last summer.
I still don't care what you did last summer.
Yeah.
There's that. And then I caught Issa Lopez's Tigers Are Not Afraid. It is on Shudder.
I almost watched this about a month, no, about 3 weeks ago, and I keep meaning to. I'm very curious to hear about this beyond your rating you'd give him.
It's really good. It has, you know, it has child characters, which can be grating, but not so much here. I mean, you really kind of understand where these kids are coming from. It's odd in how it's very much from their perspective. So they bring up things which you just have to take on faith as being true, even though they're kind of outlandish things that they're saying. But at the same time, we do see the evidence of these things happening. Visually, it's really nicely done. It's very intimate. It is very imaginatively shot. I saw it compared to something like Devil's Backbone, and I would tend to agree with that. Yeah, a little bit. Obviously, this is much, much, much more violent. And it's, you know, it's about kids who are living in a world that is, you know, predicated on violence, and they have to just deal with that. And you know, they have disagreements, and they kind of grow together, and you really do kind of feel for them when you know things happen to them. And of course, you don't want to see things happen to them, which again, you know, when you're dealing with kids in a movie, it's that could be a dicey prospect. But Lopez really pulls it off, and pulls it off well. I would recommend it. Is it fantastic? No. It certainly has a few pacing issues here and there. But it's great. And I love seeing the animation of the graffiti that the one boy goes around painting. It's really, really, really interesting. And there's a couple of other things where, again, it's kind of magical realism sort of stuff that we're dealing with here. So you kind of have to go with certain things because they're either not explained at all, or like I said, you know, you just kind of have to, you know, say, okay, that's simply the way it is here. But yeah, no, I would definitely go recommend it. And like I said, it's on Shudder. So for those of you who have Shudder, check it out. And for those of you who don't have Shudder, if you can find it someplace else, then I would go recommend you give it a whirl.
I'd recommend it. It's been a bit of a buzz movie for a while now. I know that her and Del Toro, I think, are working on a Western involving werewolves. So that we'll see how that goes.
Oh, wow.
I'm in. And that is it for me, aside from, you know, the normal shit. Like, a Creepshow I've been watching and on Shudder, speaking of.
Yeah, the new Creepshow, that's right.
Yeah, it's... I've been let down by it. Mm. I gotta admit. I hate to admit that. But I just don't think that it's... I don't think it's lived up to the... Well, I think it's one of those things where, you know, the effort's there, the spirit is there, but it just isn't working for me. I don't think the stories are really all that great.
Is there any directors attached that we know of?
Off the top of my head, I can't think of anything. Okay, but then again, I haven't been paying attention to the credits on it.
Is Tom Savini involved in any way?
You might be. Well, I think it's more of a.
And is he wearing
Carol
guy?
Yeah.
Is he wearing a shirt? Is he wearing a shirt at any point?
No. Would you?
Yeah. Well, no.
If you were 80 years old and you were jacked like that.
Yeah. Yeah. He's got that Stallone juice going.
Yeah. Right.
I think it's mostly Greg Nicotero's baby. I think that's.
I'm pretty sure it is. Yeah. And like I said, I mean, the spirit is there. They do use, you know, King stories here and there. And it tries. And I think that in certain ways it does kind of mirror those old horror comics. But in other ways, it's just is very much kind of a regular old anthology show. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I haven't been really bowled over by any of them. They seem really obvious. And like not in a good kind of obvious way. So I'm going to keep watching it.
Because you're a horror fan.
Episodes.
Yeah, because you're a horror fan, you are going to keep watching. That's right.
Exactly. I can't help it. I need that crack.
Yes, right.
Let me ask you, Todd, in terms of quality, because I'd been hovering around this one for a while and I was really excited and, you know, I thought this should be pretty cool. And I hadn't gotten a chance to dip my toe in it yet. So when you said that, I'm a little let down. But I mean, not that I had overly high expectations on a quality scale. Is it, if Creepshow is, you know, quality and Creepshow 2 is what Creepshow 2 is, mm-hmm. is it in between there or is it lesser even than Creepshow 2?
No, I would say it's in between there.
Okay, well, that's still, I think,
As of right now, I'd probably go, if I was going to score it, as of right now, the number of episodes that are out there, I'd go probably a little over 6, maybe 6.25, give or take.
You could do worse, I guess, then.
You could do worse. I don't like to say that I'm disappointed in something like this, which should be, you know, right up my alley. And I applaud them for getting it done at all, as usual. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, yeah, it's just, it hasn't been working for me. And I know some folks have been loving the shit out of it and, you know, hey, God bless, but, not so much for me, unfortunately. So there's that.
All right. Sounds good. Is that everything then?
That is it, sir. All unless right. you want me to do Joker.
No, we don't need to talk about Joker anymore. I was hoping you would, what's your thoughts on Martin Scorsese calling comic book films not cinema? I can't even say it with a straight face. Anyway, don't even open that can of worms. Lars William, you watched anything outside?
What do you mean?
Yeah, God.
I had no time for anything this week, unfortunately. Well, I got a few things in, but it was very early in the week. I'm trying to do 31 Days of Horror, which has turned into, I'm going to go like 5 for 31. Yeah. Dad batting average.
Yeah.
So we've got a couple, you know, got a couple kid-friendly things in. I've been meaning to rewatch Frank and Weenie with the Kids for some time now that they're older and now that they have a dog.
Yeah.
And I'm really, actually, I think we did this like Sunday night because it was Thanksgiving here last weekend. So we did it Sunday night. Because the kids didn't have to get up early. And it went over really, really well.
Yeah.
It was a nice rewatch. It got Braden at the end. Poor guy.
Yeah. I love Frank and Weenie, man. I love
that. Oh, man. It's good. It's a good one.
That's a good one.
It's a good one. And I think the thing that I'll just sort of put both of them together because I kind of echo the same sentiment about both is Nightmare Before Christmas. You know, often watched, well loved. But I think the thing when I go back and look at them is how much love and care goes into them and what labors of love they were. And it's all on the screen, you know, and I'm really thankful that my kids have those, you know, stuff they can look back on. And I think that, you know, we talk about filmmakers losing their touch a bit, but for us, Burton is, you know, a filmmaker my kids are going to and have grown up with. So they really love Tim Burton. So it's to the point where I can say to him or say to them, oh yeah, this is a Tim Burton film. And they'll be all in, right? And, you know, some of his back of his catalog, you know, I'm not going to probably get into too much. I may have White Apes, but even still, I just, it's been great to revisit his stuff and have it mean something to my kids.
Yeah, Burton is one of those guys who, even though he has certainly become a little more sedate or what's what I'm looking for? Like like happy with where he's at.
Absolutely.
So you'll see a ton of real innovation. You do still see, you do still kind of get a sense of wonder out of the guy.
But there's a lot of comfort zone too, right?
Yeah. That's absolutely there. But I mean, that's one of the things that I still admire about him and why I'm usually willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. On some things. I mean, some of his stuff just looks like absolute frickin' garbage. But,
I forgive him on a lot. I can tell you that. I've noticed that I do too. Because,
I do too.
Like with Dark Shadows, like I didn't even want to watch that. I sat down and watched it. And I was
like that.
Yeah, and I laughed my ass off.
I got to watch it.
Yeah. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I laughed my ass off at a lot of it, and I was like, you know what? This is why I like Tim Burton, because it's there's this sensibility of Tim Burton that comes out in his material. And of course, I grew up loving the Addams Family and Munsters and things like that. And there's always that tinge of that mixed with Disney and everything that he does. There's that, you know, that kind of dark gallows humor mixed with kid fare. And he's definitely a filmmaker, even though I think he's older than us, Todd and I especially. I think he's more a film. He's very much a filmmaker of our generation in a lot of ways. You can sense that.
Oh my God, yeah.
And his likes and loves, I think, helped to inform our generation to some degree, because it felt like one of us, or the voice of one of us, right? That was just a little bit ahead of us. It's almost like having that high school senior and we're all freshmen, you know, kind of, you know, it's cool. You look at them too for kind of some guidance in some way. I don't know, but
yeah, me and Braden, man, end of Frankenweenie, I'd be the same way.
Oh man, then he gets me and I'm trying to go, it's okay. And you know.
Yeah, I know.
Oh man. when we rewatch Iron Giant, I can't even mention that film without that lump in the throat. It's great that these exist. And I want to say this, speaking about Tim Burton, if anyone lives in Las Vegas or the California area, I happen to stumble on what looks to be a pretty cool Tim Burton exhibit at the Neon Museum in Las Vegas. That's just started. It's running, I think, until December. So
nice.
It looks pretty cool. And that Neon Museum is like the graveyard for all the old Vegas like neon signs. So I was going to go there anyway. And then I heard about that Burton installation. And I was like, take my money now. This is amazing.
Nice.
So for those in the area. But yeah, that's it. I haven't watched anything else. I wanted to watch a lot. I'm looking at my friends watching a film a day for Halloween. It's like, how the fuck do you do this? Because, you know, and a side note, my dog was just chewing a lava rock. I don't know where it came from or how she got it. And I hope it's a lava rock.
Nice.
I should say.
And not a meteor?
Yeah. I love that you say
not an old shit.
I love that you say, ooh. Oh.
You love that I say lava rock?
Yeah, I love that you say, lava.
Yeah. Oh, lava.
Yeah, no, I just say. Yeah. Well, I mean, I've heard it both ways, lava and lava. So you know.
Yeah, lava.
But I love it. You dropped that lava rock on us.
That's kind of like how Travolta says it in Pulp Fiction.
It is kind of like he says it, but you know, now that I think about it, lava rocks and petrified turds, very similar and very similar.
Well, that's what my fear is. I'm gonna give it the old scratch and sniff here on air.
Don't
do it on air.
Scratch and sniff, yeah. Oh, I can tell you this right now. There's definitely a difference between a petrified turd and a lava rock. So
No, I think I'm good.
Yeah, I watched a couple things. My daughter and I watched Toy Story. She dug it. The original Toy Story. It's funny. You go back and watch. Good. Yeah, you watch these old computer animated films, and it's very interesting to see the growth in computer animation. You know, and the way they look. Some people have railed on this thing because they say it looks rough. Yeah, it does. I mean, compared to modern technological feats that they can do with computer animation, it does look a little chintzy in some ways, but it still holds up pretty well. We enjoyed it. She enjoyed it. She didn't like, what's the name of the kid next door? Sid. She didn't like Sid. Sid got on her nerves with his laughter and his evilness. And she really didn't like him. She's like, he's bad. I was like, yeah, he is. So, you know, Sid's, you know, that kind of laughter. So
he's a jerk.
He is such a jerk, Sid. He's destroying all of his toys. The thing about Sid that drives me crazy is he gets a Buzz Lightyear. He gets a Buzz Lightyear out of the Pizza Planet thing. And he immediately wants to strap a rocket to it and destroy it. I mean, even kids I know who did destroy their toys didn't destroy the toy they just got.
No. My kids they love when Sid gets it. It's like one of their favorite things.
It is a great moment of comeuppance. Like it is a great moment. My daughter liked it too, you know. And Sid's overreaction is like, he starts running around. It's pretty funny. Anyway, yeah, he's such a shit, you know, Sid.
Oh, he is such a little shit.
And he picks on his sister and everything, man. Yeah. I always tell myself I wouldn't whip a kid, but man, I think I'd beat the shit out of Sid.
Oh man, Sid is something else. I think he breaks, like, doesn't he even like take his sister's toys and like ruin them and use them?
Yeah, he just takes her doll from her.
Fucking kid, man.
And tears the head off of it and, you know, does his little Frankenstein creations and gives it back to her, and she's like, you know, emotionally distraught. And the whole time as a parent now I'm watching, I'm like, how come the parents aren't getting involved here?
Yeah, they're very passive in all this.
Yes. Let Sid just run roughshod over the whole house. So yeah. Anyway, but no, I enjoy the Toy Story films. I haven't seen the newest one yet. My daughter, that's the reason why we ended up watching it. We had seen previews, obviously, for Toy Story 4 and trailers and stuff like that. So, and we've got my son, she's got some, you know, as the second kid is always known to have, you get the hand-me-down toys too.
Oh yeah.
And so my son had a really nice Buzz Lightyear doll figure, a big plastic one. It's real nice. And she's been carrying that around a little bit lately. And so I brought up that there's a movie with him in it, and she's like, oh, I got to watch it. So, and that's the other thing I kind of like about the movie. I kind of like the arc of Buzz Lightyear in the first film. I like that he has to realize that he's a toy, you know, so Tom Hanks impersonation there.
That's a good one.
Yeah. I watched that, and I watched a movie called Helltown. So this is a documentary. Some of you may know that I enjoyed the two documentaries by Jay Cheel, the fellow podcaster at Film Junk, who he's made two that I really like, Beauty Day and How to Build a Time Machine. Both of them are very good. And so he made a film. I remember hearing that he made a film for Travel Channel or Discovery or something like that. Again, you get work where you can. He made a documentary called Helltown, which is about this small town in Ohio. And I knew that he was a big fan of Werner Herzog and things like that. So it's not really a real. So it starts out like a Blair Witch Project type thing, and you can immediately tell if you're savvy enough that it's not a real documentary. It's kind of an incident at Loch Ness or a. You know, something like that. It's definitely heavily inspired by Incident at Loch Ness, I would say. So if you've seen that, you kind of know what I'm talking about. And if you haven't seen that, make sure you check that out. That's a great kind of, they call them a mockumentary, but I don't really consider those mockumentaries because they're not really so much full-blown comedy as they are kind of narrative documentaries that kind of play with the documentary style a little bit, right? But Helltown is not as good as his other two films. It's interesting, but the acting... this kind of false acting that you get from the characters in the movie, really obnoxious. And that's the real shame of it. It kind of plays with urban legends and stuff, and it's kind of fun and interesting, and I think he did a good job with what he had, but some of the characters in the film are not, they're just not my cup of tea. So, you know, it was an interesting attempt at something, but I just don't think it's very good, but that's just me. It's out there if you guys want to see it. I have DirecTV here at the house, so it's, you know, you can find it out there on DirecTV somewhere, but I'm sure you can find anything anywhere nowadays. So I'm sure if you want to check it out, you can, but I know there's probably some listeners that listen to Film Junk here that listen to us, and I'm sure they're probably interested about that. So, yeah, I mean, is it worth a watch? If you liked his other two films, I think so, but... If you haven't seen those, I'd go watch those first. Those are much more interesting. So, yeah. And that's it. That's all I've watched. We attempted to watch Aladdin, a little bit of Aladdin. But we did watch, like, for some reason, we watched the back end of it. I have no idea why. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. That's just me talking out loud. So, that's everything we've watched then. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and talk. Every time I look at my notes, I want to say scalped. We're going to come back, and which is a very GGTMC type of scalps. And that is that a Richard Harrison jam, I think? We're going to come back and talk some scalp. Yeah. We'll be back right after this.
Down.
some Southern Gothic jams there. So, hope everybody enjoys the Dead Tongues. Well, ebb and flow. All right. So, we are back now. We're going to talk about Scalpel from 1977. Directed by John Grismer, a psychopathic plastic surgeon transforms a young accident victim into the spitting image of his missing daughter. And it just goes from there. this is an interesting one, to say the least. And one I had never seen. I don't think any of the three of us had seen this, yeah?
No way.
Nope.
Yeah, I'd never even heard of it until the Arrow release.
Yep, so there you go. So this is... I got to admit, I hadn't either. I had to turn in my movie geek card, I guess. I don't know. But, no, this is one of those ones, I guess, that just, you know, it made it in the 70s. And it's certainly a 70s movie. I don't think you could make – well, I know you couldn't make this movie today. But you certainly couldn't make it today. I think Will's going to lead on this one, if I'm not
sure.
Mistaken. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. I'd be glad to. I think you couldn't make this movie today, as you'd said. It, not to give too much away, but there's shades of a certain subgenre of film of a different kind that this is kind of riding the wave on. And that might have been a bit of a minor inspiration. You look at things like Franju's Eyes Without a Face. It's kind of an amalgamation of a few different things, but this felt to me, just to be forthright in watching it, it felt almost like a Vinegar Syndrome kind of release. Like, it feels like a very regional kind of thriller drive-in.
Yeah, it does feel that way. Yeah,
you know, film. It's not a horror film per se. It's more of a Hitchcocky kind of thriller, or you know, De Palma Sisters, or.
Did you guys watch the cinematographer recommended version, or did you watch the regular version?
There's two. I was going to ask that. Actually, it's funny you say that, because that was one of my notes was, did you watch the Edward Lachman grade or the Arrow grade? I watched the Edward Lachman grade.
I watched the Lachman grade as well. Todd?
Yeah. Lachman, great.
If I was a betting man, I would have bet that you guys had done the same as I had.
Yes. So that adds a kind of a soft yellow kind of glow to the whole movie.
Ambery.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes it feel more Southern Gothic than it already is.
Yeah, it does. It does. And I think it serves the film well, because, again, this is another week, another outstanding Arrow release. Mm-hmm. The crew that works on restoring the films, and I don't know if this one, I didn't look it back to see if this had had a good VHS release. I don't know.
I want to say that it did, I couldn't, because it looks like one of those ones that I would have kind of passed over.
Sure.
In the video store, but I couldn't say 100%.
It just feels like one of those that. I would have, we all have seen boxes that, even if we've never seen, we're so familiar with them, mm-hmm. right? This one I just was completely clueless on. So, and like Sammy said, some stuff that was made in the 70s would have sold better or rented better in the 80s than others. And this is kind of betwixt and between a little bit. I was curious about that because I guess I hadn't seen it. So Edward Lachman, DOP. It was an interesting choice for them to be able to do that. I think it's always wise when you have a filmmaker like Grismer, who I'm sure was consulted in some capacity on releases, just like the Bird with the Crystal Plumage. There's that release, which, for better or worse, by Storero, when they allow the people that are they're tasked with the aesthetic of a film, and allowing them to great, my dog's fucking chiming in. Allow them to do their thing. I gotta say, I had not recalled seeing Robert Lansing in too many things.
He was more of a television guy than anything else, if I remember correctly. I know the three movies I could think of off the top of my head that genre people would know him from would be something like this, Empire of the Ants, and The Nest.
Yeah.
So if you've seen any of those three movies, then you're familiar with Lansing. And, you know, he's one of those guys that I always get the feeling that he never gave a shit about anything in his entire life. whenever I see him on screen, even when he's supposed to be like pleasant, he comes off as, you know, like, fuck you. And I got to say that that's his appeal. As well as just kind of being his, the vibe.
Yeah.
And I think that here in this movie, it actually works for him pretty well.
It works for him great in this movie because I absolutely despised his character.
Well, yeah, and he's a complete sociopath.
Yes,
he is. Yeah. He absolutely is. And that's the thing. It just felt like a role that he was made to play. Mm-hmm. Right from his opening lines when he's at the hospital and he's just debriefing some of the other physicians or surgeons on plastic surgery. It just felt perfect for him. He gives off a little bit of a Lee Majors vibe to me, at least early on.
Yeah, a little bit.
Before he kind of settled in.
Yeah, he's a couple buttons unbuttoned, a little bit of chest hair.
Yeah, he's not afraid of a neckerchief.
Yeah.
No, he's sure ain't.
That's right. He's definitely a Southern aristocratic, or at least he wants to be that type of person. Of course, you sense that he's married into money a little bit as well. And there's a really great scene of him talking about his wife having an accident. It's one of my favorite scenes in the movie.
Yeah, that's great.
Because it's like, okay, now we know what we're dealing with the rest of this movie. We know what kind of character we're dealing with.
Which
is pretty, because he's pretty vile. And that just seals the deal.
Yep. It does. Now, it would have been an interesting choice to go the other way and almost, but I think at some point the film gets to a point where you, even if they subtly allude to things, you come to a point in the film where then you go, oh, okay, so he really is this.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Like, there's no more, there wouldn't be any more wondering anymore.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely plenty of weird things about his character, but, you know, Grismer, he really kind of does a nice job revealing these things as they're needed.
He does.
So you know up front that he's kind of a shitheel, you know, maybe arrogant or whatever. But you know, as he reveals just how deep this guy's depravity goes, you know, he does a really nice job with how he lays it out, with how he paces it out. I thought
I agree completely. And I mean, it's too bad, you know. Grismer did two films 10 years apart.
Yeah,
both films. And I mean, I don't mean this as a critique necessarily, but at all, I shouldn't say this. I don't at all. They're very different feeling films. Blood Rage feels very much of the year it came out, 1987.
Yes, it does.
I mean, pure 19. This one feels very 1977.
Yeah, I was telling Todd before you got on, this one feels much. It's weird. They both feel, you know, solid, but this one feels much more sure-handed.
Mm-hmm. It is much more sure-handed, whereas Blood Rage feels more like a, let's ride the wave of slashers and just, you know, like not a hacky regional filmmaker, but it feels more just someone could step in and throw something together, and it's kind of a standard kind of bonkers low budget slasher, whereas this does show more of a short hand. And that's actually what I was going to say, was seeing this, it kind of makes me a little bummed that he didn't have a few more films to go through.
Yeah, I know. I was telling Todd, I don't know what happened. I don't know. You know, we were kind of talking about it as kind of middle-aged men. You know, maybe he just found a more steady job, or, you know, maybe he just found something that paid week to week. You know, a lot of times, you know, these guys, or a lot of people go to film school. You know, there's a lot of people that work behind the scenes that work on TV shows year-round. They work on doing stuff like that. It's a steady paycheck. And at the end of the day, you gotta make money. You know, not everybody gets an opportunity to... You know, not everybody's Marty Scorsese. Not everybody's these guys that get to make a living doing it. A lot of film directors, I know, I'm watching a lot of TV nowadays. I see a lot of filmmakers that I used to wonder what happened to. A lot of them pop up as directors of episodes.
Yeah, or even actors as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I mean, you go where the money is. You know, I mean, it's a career, and I can't remember who it was the first time I heard it. It may have been Alan Arkin, but he once said, I believe it was him, he once said, hey, you're working. As long as you're working, you're living.
Yes, and I get that now. It's funny, as even in the course of time we've done the show, I'm a lot more forgiving of actors I love that aren't just doing it for the craft.
That's right.
Hey, yeah, you come to really appreciate guys like Michael Caine.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
People who, they're good enough that even in stuff that is bad and you kind of go, okay, mm-hmm. they class them up. Like, well, for prime example, when I was watching Austin Powers 3 a few weeks ago, Michael Caine's absolutely fun in the role.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
He's not lazy. He's a total pro. You know, he brings exactly what Michael Caine brings, and but it doesn't feel mailed in.
Yeah, he's Teflon anyway. When it comes to, in my opinion, critically, he's Teflon. Like he's made some true turds, but I know that, you know, everybody loves Michael Caine, so he can do anything he wants. I think he's Teflon.
Yeah, he totally is. The lead in this, well, one of the male lead, Robert Lansing, he also reminded me a little bit of like Tom Jones. A little bit.
Yes.
Yeah. It's weird.
Not he's, unusual world to be.
But he is one unusual cat, but he is a piece of shit. And it's funny to follow him. And I think it's testament to his charisma that we've all watched a number of films where, at least for the first bit of the film, we see he's a total dirtbag. But we can't help but follow along, and we shouldn't be rooting for him, but we're kind of hoping he doesn't get nailed right away, at least. And
yeah.
Well, he's compelling.
He is compelling, and it's testament to his ability that we go that route. Because some people, you just want them off the screen, man. Just get rid of them.
Yeah.
But he is a compelling sleazebag.
Yeah, sure. So this gets into that interesting conversation we've had over the last few months. You know, the Dragged Across Concrete guys, the Joker film, these movies where we have shitty characters that we're supposed to quote unquote get behind. And this is always my argument. These are forms of entertainment. They're not, they're not how you believe. And when people start taking stuff personal, in my opinion, it really is disturbing to me that they think that these things can have that much power. Because, you know, I watch a lot of films with a lot of characters doing a lot of things that I would never think about doing, ever. Precisely. It never even would cross my mind. And I get off on it. I enjoy it. I, for lack of a better word, that's what I want in my movies. I want to live a lifestyle I don't understand. I want to live through that. Now, and when it's over, guess what? I'm back to being myself.
Yeah.
That's right.
I think when we, as a society, when we condemn movies, especially before we even see them, when we condemn movies, I think we're doing nothing, but it's just another form of censorship, in my opinion. And we shouldn't do that. I mean, we should all think that we're smart enough to see something with shitty characters or shitty people in it and walk out of the theater and be like, yeah, fuck, man, I'd never do nothing like that. What a piece of shit. Let's go get a burger, man, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I love about the 70s in particular. Is the 70s was a great decade of gray area characters, and even worse, and they made films about them. And I think we're starting to see that kind of come back around a little bit, maybe. And I think people aren't ready for it. I don't think our modern society is. I think
you're going to see some films that are going to fail commercially, but they're going to be reappraised critically, or at the time critically they'll do well enough that people understand that. And I agree with you. I do lament the loss of. We could watch a film that was morally ambiguous. And to even go beyond that, we don't need things tied up in a bow. Look at a lot of the great neo-noirs of the late 70s and early 80s, like Night Moves and Clued, and even stuff, you know, early, like some of the paranoid thrillers that came out. They weren't tied up in a bow.
Yeah.
And that's okay, right? And we don't need to have things clean, right? Because the 70s were a messy decade in America, and that reflected in the art that was being put out.
Yeah.
Well, I think story, which is a good thing.
Yeah, storytelling in general is a reflection of society. So there has to be, it can't all be Captain America. It can't all be, you know.
There's room for Captain America, but it doesn't need to be one size fits all Captain America.
And you can go to every one of those happy-go-lucky movies you want to go to, and that's great. But there's gotta be characters that are not, you know, I mean the Joker. not to get Todd talking again. But I mean, the you know, that's a film that's made about a type of person in society. I'm not going to use the catchphrases and the catchwords, but it's an abysmal character. But it's an abysmal character that exists in our society right now. I haven't even seen the film, but I just from what I've read, I mean, the storytelling is a reflection of us, and whether we like it or not, doesn't matter. It's a reflection of who we are. There's a lot of things I don't like, you know, but I'll still watch the films, right? So,
precisely. I mean, unless it's been explicitly spelled out that a filmmaker is pushing a really vile agenda.
Yeah.
Actively looking to do that to stir the pot, and I don't even mean in like a Lars von Trier way, where they're trying to antagonize their audience. I just mean some that were, you know, willfully pushing something that I was completely opposed to. Otherwise, yeah, I mean, I think there has to be room for people to discuss and process and view this stuff, right? It's art, and it's something we can interpret. And yeah, I'm with you 100%, 100%. But this feels very much of the decade, like you said. It couldn't have been made today. I like how regional it feels. Like they get a lot of, you know, great shots of some. Well, there's a lot of interiors here, but some of the Georgia exteriors, it feels fantastic. I couldn't help but think of The Visitor.
Yeah, yeah, it feels
right because it was shot in Atlanta as well.
Yeah, very humid, very sticky,
very swampy. Yeah.
Feels like where it should, you know, like shot, shot in Georgia. Looks like the whole thing was shot in Georgia, yeah, so.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. What else do I got here? Because I got a lot of messy notes. I'll tell you one thing I thought about, and this is going to be such an obvious statement, but it's something that didn't strike me until I watched this film. So something happens in this film that kind of gets the whole film moving. Dr. Reynolds' character and I guess Uncle Bradley, who I think Snyder's fantastic in his role, I should say.
Yeah. And he's a despicable character as well, right? So
I got a huge Strother Martin vibe off of him.
Oh, yes. That's a great call.
Yeah.
That's a great call, but he's fantastic. And I think that's, one of the things when we mentioned Grismer not working more is to be able to get these really great performances and cast sort of pro actors here. But there's a scene when they happen upon this woman who's been things escalated quickly for her, clearly.
Oh, yes.
Man, they did. And she's bloody. Her face is very bloody. And she's at least topless. I think she's wearing just like a bikini bottom or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And it struck me that a lot of times in our horror films, and maybe it was just a thing I hadn't really thought through well enough, but a lot of times in our horror films, we're content to have the violence and the blood, and we're content to have the nudity. But it seems like rarely do those two things intersect at the same time on screen. I mean, you get some, of course, but we're often more comfortable as a North American audience having our sex scene and then, you know, 10 minutes later having our kill.
Yeah.
A lot of times. Or if the couple's getting killed post-sex, it's, I don't know. This felt very stark to me, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Uh-huh. I mean, absolutely. Her face is bloody and she's top. It felt very vulnerable and even more awful because of her vulnerability because she's nude.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree with you. There's a have our cake and eat it too type thing with American sensibilities. We don't like to. I think it's what I like about some of, to kind of go back to what me and Todd were talking about earlier. I think of what some of the things I kind of like about some of the newer horror filmmakers, the Ajas and even Rob Zombie to some degree, is I think I've always enjoyed, and this sounds awful to say, but it's true, the mixture of violence and nudity. Mm-hmm. It seems like it takes the stakes up a notch.
It's a vulnerability that
that's what makes it interesting is, you know, they are more vulnerable, you know, no clothes on in the middle of a violent situation. And there's something about our society too that, you know, we are more comfortable when we separate the two. We love our nudity and our sleaze, but we also love for our violence to try to be as separate from that as possible.
We don't like our food to touch on the plate.
That's right.
Yes.
Don't want to mix our veggies there, bae.
No. Which to me, I like to mix it all up. If nothing else, I think it asks questions. It forces us to answer questions or confront some things. This felt to me, and I don't mean this as a critique. Again, I mean it more as an observation. It felt like a really high-end made-for-TV movie.
In certain ways, it does, and especially when you get into stuff like the score, which there's glamour music going on during the surgery,
which I really love. It's weird. I don't know. It worked for me somehow. It was,
I like the surgery scene. Yeah. The surgery scene's good. It's gross without being, it feels kind of real.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like you can see him shaping the chin with the little drill thing, and you can see the way they take the skin off. It's not as kind of graphic as it was in Rabid. Didn't we do the same? Didn't Rabid have a little bit of? Yeah.
Yes, it did.
Yeah, it had a removal of some skin off a thigh or a butt cheek or something. But this one, it felt like that's what they would really, this kind of slow skin graphing machine, which really bothered me.
Oh, man.
Yeah, really bothered me. I was like,
it's like a cheese slicer.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Hope nobody had any salt with their lunch. It's going to burn. That bacon strip. Now that, but the surgery scene felt pretty real. And that kind of goes back to what Will was saying. I'm surprised I liked the Robert Lansing performance as much as I did. He felt very natural in this movie. He's very much got the God complex going. You know, plastic surgery, it was a horror thing for a while. It's kind of went by the wayside a little bit, although I think, what was that film we watched? The Banderas film, The Skin I Live In or whatever.
Which there's, of course, you couldn't help but think of that to a degree too.
Yeah. That really kind of brought it back in some ways, but it didn't really bring the genre back. I haven't really seen a whole lot of that stuff, but I've always enjoyed these plastic surgery, face changing films. I don't know. There's something sick and twisted about them and something bothersome about them to me. And they kind of work psychologically. This one really goes into some dark places, but it does feel like a TV film, but it does also, it goes into those dark areas that remind you that it's not a TV film.
Well, and I think when you're looking at identity and the psychology within oneself, right, and how we identify, not only self-identify, but how we are identified by others, right? You really go down a rabbit hole. And can ask yourself and be asked a lot of questions. Was it Seconds and what's the other Frankenheimer one? Is it Seconds?
Yeah, Seconds is the Frankenheimer one.
Then there's the Japanese one that's very similar to that.
Oh, The Face of Another?
Face of Another, right? Yeah, so you
really good. Film. I reviewed that with Mike and them over at the projection booth. That's a really good one.
Yeah, fantastic film, right? So, you know, you kind of get that stuff. And this... And I got to say, Judith Chapman, who clearly is either a vampire or has great genes, she looks like this film was made 40 plus years ago, and she looks like she's about, you know, late 50s here.
Yeah, so
when you see her in the interview.
Yeah, no, she might be more attractive now than she was then.
Yeah, it's crazy, but I want to give it up to her too. I think she puts in a really great nuanced performance. I mean, there's not a huge divide between the Heather and Jane characters, but there's enough.
That's enough.
That scene, and she puts in
that scene in the bedroom with them, with her playing both roles, is pretty well done. She does a pretty good job, I think.
She does.
Little nuances between, so you can kind of tell these little nuances between who's Jane and who's Heather.
Yeah.
And one thing I haven't mentioned here is I want to give it up to the editor of this one, because between that stuff, there's nothing too clumsy. And then some of the flashbacks as well. I think they do a really good job of having, some kind of nice voiceovers that are in stark contrast to what we're seeing, in a way that's almost darkly humorous, right? So Christopher Ness and Joseph Weintraub edited the film. So gonna name drop them. What else? Why do I say great head of ham? That means I don't know. I'm gonna skip on past that.
I don't know if I remember that.
That head of him. I know that, again, as I mentioned earlier, they make really great use of the locales. There's some really gorgeous green spaces and this plantation that they shoot on. It's a really gorgeous location. They get a lot of value for that. And the cinematography is great too. Some of it's functional, but we get enough flourishes. Like there's some kind of nice slow pullbacks with the camera and reveals and some stuff that works really well. It just feels like a very competent production to me.
Yeah.
Right.
Feels the same way.
Oh yeah. It's slick enough. It's slick enough. It's professional. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think maybe what was this film's fate prior to Arrow releasing it is it wasn't overt or kind of over the top enough for horror audiences, but because it's still a genre film, it touches on some sleazy things. It wouldn't be assessed in a way that like a Clute or something would. Mm. You know, it's betwixt and between a little bit, even though it's really very competently made and professionally made.
Well, it's down. Yeah, it's down the rung a little bit from something like Clute in people's eyes. Although, you know, I think that it certainly has enough to recommend it to people. Outside of that, you know, on par with Clute, maybe not. But
Clute's fantastic. But for it to not even be mentioned as like, you know, the little cousin again, not to say
there's a linear comparison,
but it deserves to be talked about. I think more.
Sure. Absolutely. Right?
Yep. I think Grismer makes great use of tension when there's the big welcome home party and there's that piano scene. I think he could have maybe stretched it a little more, but that's great.
That's great. The look on her face when she sits down at the piano. I loved it.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
It was really, really good. There's a lot of bad suits and bad hair on the dudes in this.
What do you mean bad?
Well, there's suit by Ron Burgundy, hair by Captain Kangaroo on that one guy. Man, he's got bad fucking hair.
Yeah.
There's a few dudes with bad, even the doctor. It's like, dude, you got to trim down the sides. I know 70s people didn't care as much about no hair on top, but he's really voluminous on the sides. it's insane. What else do we got here? How about just some of the stuff isn't, I don't know, it works on screen, like the Dixieland kind of band, the funeral. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of that dramatic will reading times two. I think this one's got a lot going for it. You know, the plot gets thickened at the funeral. I mean, it was inevitable that we knew that it was going to come to this, but it's, it just kind of doles stuff out with a patient hand that I really like. Mm-hmm. What else do we got here? And I think, too, this handles at least the early initial scenes between the three characters. Kind of the two's company, three's a crowd stuff. You know, they're kind of finding their footing. And at the time, Lansing's character's holding the cards, right? And then that kind of gets turned on him a little bit. But... Mm-hmm. It's it works good. There's some stuff that looks like a slasher. There's a pursuit through the woods that they roll with. But yeah, I mean, I could keep going, but I just want to say that, you know, kudos to Arrow again for, I'm playing my hand here a bit, but dropping stuff on the floor while I'm at it. they do just, you know, kudos to them for digging this one up and putting it out, because as we said, just because it's betwixt and between doesn't mean it doesn't have an audience. And I think we're prime examples of that. So I'll kick it over to you guys.
Todd, you got anything you want to add?
A couple things. Let me see here. Okay. So we get the wavy flashback transition in the film. Yeah. And actually, we get it a couple times. And it's something that you're more used to seeing on television.
Gilligan's Island.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, that was one of the things that kind of, you know, going back to what Will was saying about how it does kind of have a little bit of a TV vibe to it. It's kind of creepy watching your daughter get laid. Lansing. Lansing's a little. He's down. He's down for that, I guess.
He is a fucking. And there's.
Yeah, pig. I mean, that's just the you know, that's just the opening of a volley of his creepiness,
yep.
Really.
Yep.
And then he North by Northwest's the guy.
Yeah.
I find it interesting that, you know, Lansing refers to himself as Frankenstein, and he's not entirely wrong. I mean, like, when you think about it, yeah, plastic surgery helps tons of people who are disfigured. But, you know, what do we usually see? We see, you know, stuff like the Kardashians or Meg Ryan.
Yeah.
So in that respect, it's kind of an interesting little way to look at it. You know, for a guy hatching a plot to disguise someone as his daughter, I was thinking to myself, maybe he shouldn't ask his assistant to get her height and hair and her eye color.
Yeah.
Before he goes ahead and does this thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're right. I think it does play a lot like Hitchcock in certain ways. It's just with a much more overt perversion, like something that would have been more like Frenzy era Hitchcock.
Yeah. Yes, end of end of his career. That
when he was really overt. Ramping it up.
Yep.
Um,
It's almost like tasteful perversion or something, you know?
As restrained or tasteful as one can be with the material.
Yeah, it's not full exploitation, but it's certainly perverted.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You got pretty much everyone in this thing who has kind of like a dark, odd streak to them. So you're kind of sitting there thinking to yourself, where I was, you know, polite society is just that. It's putting on a face.
Yeah.
Correct.
So nice little subtext there. Like we've been saying, yeah, it's nicely shot, if relatively unspectacular. Some nice stuff with the editing. It's a bit of the time here and there, but it does work well. There is the film quickly answers the first question that pops into your head about this whole thing, which is, isn't Lansing already rich enough? He says it. He says it flat out. There's never enough. So
yeah,
he's absolutely.
Which says a lot about his character. I mean, that
exactly.
You know, that
he's always going to keep pushing it.
Yeah.
It's never enough. Precisely. Yeah.
Well, it's never enough. Now he's got two daughters.
Yeah, it's a psychological. It's clear. It's you know, not just psychotic behavior, but it's a psychological disorder. I mean, you see it still to this day, not exactly like this, but what I'm saying is, you know, you see rich people basically self-destruct all the time. You know, they just can't have enough. It just, you know, it becomes a thing.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. So when the obvious turn does happen, there's still a lot going on underneath it. And I love Lansing's reaction, to the appearance of that character there, because he's close to unhinged, and I think that we really get to see all that's in his head at that point. And that's, for me, I thought that started up the most interesting part of the film. This is when, to my mind, this is when it really turns into a Southern Gothic. Like before that, it was kind of like this weird, odd little sciencey sort of bizarro movie, and then you know, then it turns into like the actual Gothic for like I said from my perspective. I love the strange this is nothing out of the ordinary sort of vibe the characters have with one another.
Yes.
Even though there's a ton boiling underneath. I gotta say, and I can't remember who did Grisman write this as well, or
yeah, he was involved in the writing. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I got to say, it's pretty well written.
It is.
All things being equal.
Yeah. So. There's some zippy kind of, especially I think some of the exchanges with Snyder and Lansing.
Yeah.
It's pretty zippy. It's well done for sure.
And then you know, there's a lot of red herrings in here, because then it starts twisting stuff, and then it's you know, it starts giving you lots of expectation, and then subverts payoff, and then gives you expectation and subverts payoff. So it really works well once we get into the back half of it. But yeah, I gotta say I was not especially looking forward to watching this, but having seen it, I'm glad I did. You know, this is a good one. Yeah. I'd go recommending this to anybody who's into anything. You know, it doesn't even have to be one of these sort of body transmogrification sort of movies like The Skin I Live In or Seconds or something like that.
Yes.
But this thing does really well. It does really well for melodrama. It does really well for, you know, I guess you could call it a psychosexual thriller, I guess. Southern Gothic, certainly. This is a good one. So
yeah,
all I got, Mr. Sammy.
All right. I don't have a whole lot more to add. I basically echo everything you guys are saying. And you know what Will said about Arrow's release of this. It's a really nice release, and I'm really glad it's out there. It's one of those ones where, you know, I probably wouldn't have popped on it if the show wasn't sponsored by Arrow. But if I heard a good review of it, like we're kind of giving it, I think I probably would pop on it. I mean, it's interesting. It's an oddity. It's almost like that, you know, like that American Horror Project stuff they put out. It does feel like a regional horror film, and it feels like this is one of these little small horror films that are not horror so much, but definitely those types of, you know, tinges, those types of taste in there, those little flavors. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely there, because there is a little bit of, you know, there's a little bit of blood to satisfy those who want that. And there's some awfulness, but more it really kind of dealing with the kind of the sociopathic kind of nature of the doctor here, who's truly insane. And Butt has a great singing voice. We should mention that.
That was such a bizarre thing when he really goes, you know.
It's like, what is going on?
Man, he almost even looks like a different person. Yeah. Like,
well, it's clearly not him singing, and you can tell. It's like,
oh, no, but I mean, even after that, yeah. Yeah, that was a weird scene. But even at the backpack, like the last 50 minutes, it almost doesn't look like him. Like his composure is completely gone, and he's just
he's
almost like a bloated mess. It's weird.
He's turning into like a more of a savage as he goes along.
Mm-hmm.
And everything's escalating for him. You know, that's I think one of the things Grismer does well is he says life is pretty mundane. He's obviously a terrible person from the get-go, but everything starts to escalate because he starts to make more and more bad decisions. And all of them based on
doubles
greed.
Down.
Yeah, all of them based on greed, really. And things just get worse and worse and worse for his character. And it's like, you know, it's like telling lies to get by in life. You know, sooner or later, you know, are you telling the lies? You know, you got to keep up with all that shit. You can't keep up with it. You told so many, now you're lying on top of your lies. You don't even know what you're saying. So it's, you know, it's very much this. I think they do a good job of this kind of pathological behavior that this character has. And really, but Lansing, you know, again, I remember him. Todd and I were talking about this, and he mentioned it already in this review. I remember him from a lot of television growing up, like a lot of shows that my mom and dad would watch. I'd always see him in them because he never really looked different. He always kind of looked the same. I don't remember him looking much different at all, except maybe sometimes he'd be wearing a military hat or something. I think his IMDb picture, I think he has a some type of military regalia on, but that's about all I remember him being different. He always looked like that, like he does in this movie. He always looked the same to me. Mm-hmm. And he does have this kind of very famous, I think he's mostly known for this kind of stare that he has, but he does have those, he's got those eyes. He's got those eyes that kind of penetrate and kind of look right through you, like, you know, I'm better than you or I'm going to kill you. He's got that look.
And, oh, totally.
It really works for him. And he's, I don't know if he's handsome, but he's handsome enough to
That's
get by
right.
as,
great. Yeah.
As, yeah, as the character. Yeah. And there's a lot of fun here. There's the training montage. There's a training montage in this film. That's something you don't expect, but there is this kind of training montage in the movie where they're kind of going over the family history and how she has to know so many things and stuff like that. So
that was good.
Yeah. And I think what, you know, these films do well, some of them, and I think this is always this always hangs on the director because this is up to them to make this choice, but you're in on the con the whole time. You're basically with the Jane character and the doctor character. You're with them characters. So you're basically in cahoots, for lack of a better term, for the majority of the film. And then at some point, you know, you're supposed to break away from that because you're like, whoa, whoa. I mean, this is going too far, Doc. You know, and I think that that's an, you know, you can attribute that to Grismer's very assured hand in this film because I went along with the whole thing. Like, I got sucked in. I went along with it. And then it gets to a point where it's like, whoa, man, you're really losing control here, man. You know, and I'm not saying I support what the characters did or anything like that. I'm just saying that, you know, for that story, I'm into it for the moment. And it takes me out of my everyday life. And it pulls me into this kind of terrible, trashy life. And then it gets to a point where I'm like, whoa, man, I'm glad my life isn't like this. And it's like, whoa, tune it out. And, you know, and then it pays off in the way it pays off. And I think it pays off well. I think it pays off the way it should.
Oh, yeah.
It's a nice twist. It's a nice little twist, right? I mean, you kind of see it coming, but it works.
But it's not totally telegraphed. But, yeah, like you said, you can pick up the dots if you're a sleuthy film goer. But, yeah, it still left a smile on my face.
Yeah, there's one thing I don't like about the ending. It's the last line of dialogue. Really grating for me as a Southerner, but, you know. It is what it is. That's a very famous thing to say in the South, and it's still said. People still say it. So it's just, you know. But it felt like a moment of, hey, look at me. We made a movie in the South.
Sure.
Know, whatever. It works for the movie. It just little. I felt like it was like it's like one of those little itty bitty things. It's just like a beat too much. Just like you know, walk away. You don't have to walk away. Turn around. Say a catchphrase and then walk away. It is a little too much, but yeah, it is interesting because we have covered Blood Rage and that has, you know, that great Thanksgiving dinner scene, but it's a totally different feel than this movie and
completely
in a lot of ways. And it's amazing, you know, that the same director made both films because this one feels again, much more assured than that film did. That film felt much more like yeah, like you said, riding the wave of what was popular at the time. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to kind of diving into the extras a little bit more, kind of find out what happened to the Grismer, see what happened, you know, why he kind of disappeared. So, yeah, let's get into Make or Breaks MVTs, Will.
Make or Break, I had a really hard time with. I think I'm going to go – I was going to say that, the Will reading and kind of that post-Will reading scene with Uncle Bradley and Lansing's character. But I'm actually going to go with that welcome home scene. I really love that piano scene because it feels like a very real-world practical anxiety. Like, just – I was on edge. And like I said, Grismer could have stretched it out a little bit more, but it still left me on edge going, oh, fuck, this is good. And because it makes you wonder not only at this point – is it an innocent, hey, come on, do this, come play the piano? Or is there something, do they know? And this is like, we're going to smoke you out here, right? So it's you're there almost as the Heather/Jane character, and it just makes for fun viewing. MVT, this is going to be one of those cheat ones. I'm going to go with everyone involved because I think you get really strong performances from the leads. It's well written. It's shot well enough. The score works for me. It's really assured direction that makes all of us, it sounds like, wish that Grismer made more films. It is a real tight professional. Wait, hang on. Let me finish that sentence because that easy. Tight professional.
Easy.
it's a tight professional production. So I'm going to go with everyone involved. My score for this one, I'm going to go 7.25. Mm-hmm. Really like this one. Like if I was going to make a pleasant surprises of the year list, this would absolutely be on there.
Nice.
Cool.
Totter?
Alrighty. I am going Make or Break. I'm going to go, you know, yeah, I agree that there's a lot of scenes you can give it to, but I'm going to go with the finale on this one. I think it really just unleashes the crazy that's been pent up the entire movie, and it satisfies. So, yeah, the scene on the couch there at the end, liked it, loved it. MVT, you know, I am going to go with Chapman. I think that she really does a great job in the dual role. You do absolutely get who's on screen whenever they switch between the two characters. So, you know, kudos to her being able to pull that off. It's really, really, really nice job. And score for me, I'm a hair higher than Will. I'm going 7.5 out of 10.
I was going to go there. Yeah, good call.
Thank you. Yeah, it really is a nice, pleasant surprise, and definitely a recommend to anybody out there. Nice. Yeah.
I'm gonna bump my score up. Usually Todd's half a point lower than me. So I'm gonna bump mine up. I gotta go. I gotta be in lockstep here with Toddy because this one deserves
nice.
Well.
Yeah.
Nice.
No. I'll totally agree, and you'll hear why. my MVT. I'm gonna go with the Grismer. I agree with what Will said. Everybody involved because it's a very well made and well paced film. I don't know if I gave it to Grismer on our Blood Rage review. I don't know what I gave the MVT to the Blood Rage review to. You know, you can't remember. I can't remember that shit. I can't remember what I had for dinner. So, you know, I'm just going to give it to the Grizz and go with it. But, yeah, that lead performance is really good. Both the lead performances are really good. And or I guess maybe even three performances if you want to get kind of catty about it. But it's very well acted. I mean, it feels like everybody's bought in, which I think is very key on films like these. My Make or Break, I'm going to go with the other piano scene.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, where Uncle Bradley has a little bit of an issue. And there's a great moment when the doctor character, Lansing, goes, "What's that, Bradley? You want to hear some music?"
Oh, It is great. This almost feels like the family from the opening, the Father's Day segment of Creepshow.
Yeah, it does kind of. Yeah. He starts playing a little chopsticks, and Bradley's having some issues there. She's like, give him a pill. And he's like, just sitting there. What's that, Bradley? Want to hear some music? I really enjoyed that scene. Because he's just such a vile character, man. I mean, he's just this is a terrible dude doing terrible things. And I think you're kind of happy with what eventually happens. My score for the film, same as you guys, 7.5. I think we're all in agreement with this one. This one is a pleasant surprise. I thought maybe I'd come in somewhere between 6 and 7, as I usually do with most things it seems like Arrow puts out. But this one, it is a pleasant surprise. It's not something I probably, from the poster art and things like that. It's not something I probably would have, you know, looked for or looked into. Mm-hmm. But as an interesting little curiosity, it's pretty awesome that it's out there. And it's pretty great, you know. So, yeah, definitely check that one out. If you guys got some extra coin, go ahead and pick it up. I think you won't be disappointed.
I agree.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and talk Killer Clowns from Outer Space from 1988. We'll be back. Did I say that? Yeah, I said that earlier, right? I didn't even remember mentioning the movie.
We'll say you did. Yes, you did. Yep.
All right. We'll be back right after this. It's like a killer clown. Yeah, it's like a, I just cut that thing off really quick.
That hard cut.
That's a fun theme song though. It's, you know, it kind of takes you to the era and all that kind of stuff. I always like when horror films or any type of film really has a theme song that's actually the theme, the title of the movie. It's like, yeah, okay. So you got to come up with that somehow. But the Dickies did a good job. It's pretty good stuff. The catchiness of that is infectious. I'll be humming that all day today. There's no doubt about that. All right. So Killer Clowns from Outer Space from the Kyoto Brothers, directed by Stephen Kyoto, but written by Charles and Stephen. And there's another, maybe an Edward Kyoto in there. Maybe. I don't know the other Kyoto's name, but yeah, they're in there. This is basically their one of their babies. They're kind of special effects guys, and very New York, those guys. I think they grew up in the Bronx, if I'm not mistaken, and you can tell. 1988, aliens who look like clowns from outer space and terrorize a small town. That's the basic plot synopsis. This is an era where, you know, they're making horror movies, and this isn't that prepackaged cult film thing. This is, you know, an era where people, I think, are still trying to make something that stands out in a legit way. And I can still remember how I heard of this movie. I want to get this out before somebody starts reviewing it. But I was watching an episode of Headbangers Ball. This tells you how old I am and what I was doing. And they had Anthrax on around Halloween time. Which is funny because it's now, so who knows how many years ago this was. And Anthrax were on there and they were talking about their favorite horror films. And then they started mentioning this film. They're like, yeah, we know it sounds ridiculous. And they're very New York too. Yeah, you know what? It sounds ridiculous. And they said, but, you know, trust me, rent this movie. It's amazing. And so I went out and rented the movie. And I have to admit, this film really holds up. It's amazing how well it holds up. It really is. And we're talking, it's 30 years old, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's fucking insane. So,
yep. Well, it was certainly a departure from any of the slashery kind of movies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a creature feature, but at the same time, I mean, this is basically a 50s sci-fi movie.
Yeah.
It's to me, looking back at it, I think it's almost like a Deckery, Night of the Creeps. It is informed by the stuff in the 50s very much in comics and everything else, but it's made with so much love and care and skill that regardless of how of its time and not it feel or not it feels, it is aged perfectly to the point where my kids adore it.
Yeah. No, it's a lot of fun. It really
and
is.
Blu-ray.
Oof.
Yeah, thing does pop. So I don't know who wants to lead on. I'm assuming Todd might. I don't know what your thoughts are on a character name like Mike Tobacco, but I love it.
Yeah, it's how do you not like that?
That's a great character name. Yeah.
Oh God, yeah. Well, he was. He reminded me of. Well, I should say this. Grant Kramer, in and of himself, always reminded me of Casey Kasem from The Incredible Two-Headed Transplant. Just to whip that one out there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you start the movie off with the Dickey song and John Vernon just acting absolutely fucking cranky. Vernon has possibly the biggest stick up his ass of his entire career in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
But he's also... The funny thing is, he's also like the standout character... in the film.
Yeah, he is.
He's supposed to be the authority figure who just, you know, doesn't buy into any of this bullshit. He hates the youths or what have you. He's great every time that he's on screen, man. Mm-hmm. Every single time he's on screen. He comes close to stealing the show from the special effects, which are really the reason that this thing exists, by and large.
Yeah, no, Vernon, he steals every scene he's in, even the scene with the clown in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
The clown uses him as a ventriloquist dummy, and it's pretty amazing.
Yep. It is a well. And I think, too, you know, as much as this stuff looks great on screen, a lot of it's really fun in how it was conceived, right? To be able to come out. It's very imaginative. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. I think
some of that stuff's really well. It works really well.
You have the classic "Let's sell ice cream on Lover's Lane, but really try to get some action" ploy.
Yeah.
That the Terenzi brothers use. And if the film has a flaw, I think it's the Terenzi brothers. I think they're a bit much to take sometimes, but you also get the feeling that the Kyotos based them on themselves.
Yeah.
Yes.
And there is a certain likability to them. They're just kind of a little bit, you know, for how wacky the rest of the film is, they're a little bit less grounded than any of the other characters. So that's a good and a bad thing because, you know, all the other characters are so milk-toasty white, where the Terenzi brothers are kind of just, you know, out of their fucking minds. So I kind of don't like them, but I kind of accept why they're here and, you know, go along with it.
I tell you something. This is a pet peeve. I got to mention this just to get it down on the record. So maybe one day when I'm older, I can remember how insane I truly am. I hate when people say they're selling ice cream and all they're selling is popsicles.
What the fuck, man? That ain't ice cream.
That ain't ice cream, man.
Switch. That sure ain't ice cream. There's no cream in the fucking popsicle.
Yeah.
Unless you're selling a creamsicle.
That's different.
But that's a creamsicle, not a popsicle.
Yeah.
Even then, that's not ice cream.
Yeah, it's just sugar and water. I mean, that's all that is. That's frozen sugar and water. I mean, that's not ice cream to me.
Why don't you just give me a fucking Otter Pop while you're at it, you
motherfucker.
Yeah. I'm on Candy Camera or some shit, man. Who's fucking... Alan Funt fucking with me.
That is. So, like I said, the plot is straight out of The Blob, and then taken to extremes.
Yes,
you even get Royal Dano is the crazy old coot here.
Yeah,
that's right.
So it all just follows the formula like to a T, and then it adds a little bit of extra, you know, blood here and there, but nothing that's like over the top, really.
No, nothing over the. Just an. It's almost like, and it's funny. Will was talking about his kids loving this. And I know they've seen more graphic stuff since this, blood-wise, but it's almost like the perfect, like, and I'm sure you guys will agree, it's almost like, it's almost like a perfect first horror film.
It really is.
Gateway horror film, yeah.
Yeah. I think that, yeah. Well, I mean, what else could you think of aside from just going back to the actual, like, 50s, 30s? For gateway stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, this is certainly something that has more color.
Yeah, The Blob was definitely very influential on me early on. I mean, I remember that was one of the first horror films I saw.
The McQueen version.
Yeah. No, I like the remake quite a bit, but the
I think the remake's fantastic.
It is. I love it. But saying that, the it makes the old one look really dated and rough
and
but,
slow. I mean, honestly, like this, it might be blasphemous. I think I prefer the remake.
I prefer the remake, the sequel, and then the Blob. that's the way I would rate those. But
it's not McQueen's finest hour. It's more of a pub trivia thing than anything.
It's a fun kind of novelty film in a way.
Yes.
The Blob.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But it's
glad it's made. But
yeah. It's on Criterion right now, and I was going to watch it in the commentary track. I didn't get around to it.
I watched it with my mom last Halloween, actually.
Oh, nice. Yeah. It's slow. It's 80 minutes, 80-something minutes, and it feels like it's 3 hours long.
110, yeah.
Yeah. It's rough.
Now, yeah, go ahead.
No, I just said it's rough.
Oh, okay. Getting back to this, had they just painted people like clowns, the film wouldn't work as it does.
Yeah.
No.
The clowns here, they have to be like gross caricatures because they're aliens, but also because they're meant to be straight out of a cartoon.
Yeah.
So they play both sides. Their humor is twisted, but it is funny, but they drink blood and their cotton candy dissolves people.
Yeah.
I think that, it's really that Kyoto attitude of playfulness that holds it all together, in line with that sort of dark, clowns are creepy sort of thing that they get going here. It's as slapstick as it is gruesome, this movie is. So, it really does do a wonderful job kind of skirting the line because of, like I said, it's the attitude.
Yeah, there's something about the skin texture of the clowns, that rubbery mask that I really love that for some reason. There's something about it that just feels, I don't know, it feels kind of gross, but it's very cool.
Yeah.
And it's in line with, as you had said, I think, was it you, Todd, or was you saying that just said about it wouldn't have worked if they'd have just used humans in makeup? Which one of you said that?
Yeah, I did.
Right, and that's a perfect point because to tie in with what you said, Sammy, about the texture. Yeah, it feels very tangible, and it works, right? And it it does feel kind of. I wouldn't want to.
Yeah.
I want to pinch their cheek and pull it, but I don't.
Yeah. They're deformed, but they're like, you want to see what it feels like, don't you?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but you do.
Are you talking about the last movie we reviewed again? Or are you talking about
the one that was on the clown movie that was on Brazzers, maybe?
Yeah. Ooh. I've seen a handful of those.
I just see what it feels like.
Yo, cake farts nearby.
Yeah.
Oh God.
Just the balloon animals too.
Yes.
that old nozzle up the ass trick. You kind of like get a little bit of like Chariots of the Gods or Quatermass in the Pit going on in here, and you can make the argument that all clowns are descended from aliens, and our characters do actually say that later on in the film. Though I think that the one Terenzi brother, and I'll give them credit here, has the best reason of all why this is happening. And it's, he says maybe they just stopped on Earth for a bite to eat.
Yeah.
In other words, they just exist. Yeah. And that's really kind of the film in, on the whole, is it just exists.
Yeah.
It is what it is.
Yeah,
it
no
makes no bones about it.
Yeah.
And you just you kind of strap yourself in and go along for the ride. And it really is, it's really kind of interesting that this movie appeals to so many people across the board. And I think that that goes back to, like we've been saying, and like I'm just going to keep beating into the dirt, how much it just apes that 50s model of this sort of film. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that that's the reason that that you buy into it. I think that that's the reason that you go along with everything odd that's going on screen initially. But then the rest of it is, completely on the Kyoto's being able to keep you there. And they do a great job. And they, this is why these guys never had the opportunity to do more and, kind of unleash their imagination is absolutely beyond me, because I really think that I would have loved to have seen it.
It's almost like the cinematic good die young. Like we often lament, again, the Deckers of the world and the Kyoto brothers of the world, people that truly love the genre and yes. and poured everything into the production, right? And you really feel that on screen. It is really a shame.
Yeah, well, because passion really doesn't make money, I guess. I don't
know. No, it fucking sucks.
I know, right? I really kind of already went over that. They pull out all the stops with the practical visual effects here.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think there's a single practical effect that they don't use. They used, let me think, forced perspective. They have miniatures. They have matte paintings. They use stop motion. You name it, it's in here. And me, I revel in that fact.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There is so much craft and imagination going on here. It more than makes up for what shortcomings the film has. And it's just a joy. It's a joy watching because, you know, I could sit there and just, you know, I'm taken back. I guess in that way, it's kind of a nostalgia thing, not just because of, you know, when I saw this, when it originally came out, but just, you know, that kind of thing that's missing now. And, you know, it is what it is. Call it what you want. Yeah. The chick who answers the door in a teddy and drinking wine.
Mm.
Because why not?
Mm.
I mean, that's like really?
gotta get that pizza.
You know, they just show up with a pizza. It's like, okay, yeah, she's just standing there like waiting for them to do something, so then they do something. You gotta love it. I think that the attack vignettes are all memorable, but the creepiest one is the one at the burger joint between
yeah.
that and the dummy scene.
Yeah.
Yes. With which I should mention both feature the same clown.
Yeah.
It's the most effective horror scene in the film, like horror film
mm-hmm. yes.
or horror scene. And I think that it proves that the clowns are a real threat.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, kind of kicks it up a notch because now it's not just that they're kind of goofballing and doing weird, funny, wacky, really visually interesting things. They actually, you know, are taking everybody down. You get that hard ticket to Hawaii clown snake in the commode. which is great. Yeah, right. And speaking of, you know, the creepier aspects of the film, I noticed that there's a very small cotton candy cocoon on the spaceship.
Mm, yes. Yeah.
And I only saw one, but I'm just like, huh, that is just, that kind of puts a period in the end of that sentence.
Is it a child? Is it a child or is it Pooh Bear?
We don't know.
We don't know. That makes it even more unnerving.
I know, right? There is a nice big finale.
They kill a dog. I mean, come on.
Oh, yeah.
The clowns are terrible.
Yeah. Well, but then again, you know, Mike Tobacco runs over the balloon dog.
That's true.
So,
yeah.
You know, who's worse?
Yeah.
Is a balloon dog not a dog just because it's made out of a balloon?
That's right.
Not in this movie. In this movie, a balloon dog is a dog.
Yeah, exactly. There is a nice big finale, but you kind of have to ask yourself, and this is always one of the things that kind of like nagged at me. You have to ask if the final shot is just goofy slapstick or a little more sinister, considering the effectiveness of cream pies that we saw earlier in the film.
Excuse me.
Ooh, whoa.
Yeah. Not that kind of cream pie. Not that kind of effectiveness.
Excuse me.
Perhaps.
Pardon?
I'm doing the Letterman like.
Yeah.
I'm tugging at my collar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Should have seen that one coming.
We're doing a video podcast.
Oh, I just you can't not pile it on with these terms.
Yeah. Exit stage left there, bae.
Ooh. But considering the effectiveness of what happens earlier when a guy gets plastered in cream pies.
No.
It's always kind of bugged me. It's like, so what happens after we fade to credits then? I mean.
Yeah. 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 It's true. Well, we know that the cream pies eat skin.
They sure do.
We know that from a close up. Yeah. We're so immature that we can't say the word without laughing.
We are.
But that's all the notes that I got. Yeah, I still love this thing. It works. It worked the first time. It worked the 100th time. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah, it's kind of a timeless piece of material. It's really interesting.
Agreed.
the way the Kyoto brothers have created something here. Will, do you want to go or you want me to go?
I think you guys hit a lot of the key notes.
I think that when you say timeless, I mean, I really do think that goes back to the model that they based it on. They just completely removed it from the time stream.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It exists in its own world.
Outside of, you know, maybe a couple of fashion choices here and there.
Sure.
Yeah.
Or sure. Maybe a couple of technological things that we have now that we didn't have then. Outside of that, it is completely of its own world, of its own time zone.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, and Todd, you segue nicely into one of the very few things I wanted to say, because as usual, you guys tick off a lot of the boxes in terms of observations, criticisms, and so forth, is I love that the Kyoto brothers are invested enough and have enough faith in their vision that they go all in. And we don't really need an overt amount of exposition. Like, this is its own world, and we're dropped into the world, so we're going to be okay with the rules and the logic that it presents to us.
Yeah,
We're going to go with it, right? And because it's well crafted enough that we don't really stop and go, oh, hang on a sec here. You know, like any good magician of sorts, they're going to razzle dazzle us, and we're not really going to, they're going to baffle us with wonderful bullshit, to use a Prince of Pennsylvania phrase. I was going to say something. I got rambling there, rambling Rose. No, I don't really have a lot of that. You ticked a lot of the bot. You got between, you know, you guys, it's you've ticked off everything. I think the one final thing I'll say is we talk about the sweet spot, 90 minutes.
Yep.
The Kidder brothers are well enough to come in under 90.
Yeah.
Right? And you got to think, it's like doing like a greatest hits album. And not even like you do an album and you put 25 songs on there. You know, if you got even some filler, perception's going to become reality that there's more filler than killer. But you keep it tight enough and you have enough going, oh, here we go back to the cream pies. You keep it tight enough and you're going to feel even punchier and it's going to pop more than it already does, because it's just like boom, 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 boom. It just start to finish quality.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's true. It's interesting going back and looking at this. I always think I'm going to go back and watch Killer Clowns. I'm going to be like, you know what? This is going to be the time I watch it, and it just doesn't really...
You're off.
Yeah. It doesn't really, you know, speak to me. But I got to say, almost everything the Kyoto brothers have been involved in, I have a soft spot for the Critters franchise, which they created the Critters themselves. Team America is the only thing I really like from the South Park guys. I know.
Agreed. I hate South Park otherwise.
Yeah, I know that's blasphemous for some, but I really enjoy Team America because it's one of the most ridiculous things I think ever committed to film. Talk about a movie you couldn't get made today. It's insane if you go back and look at that thing. oh, Jesus. I'm just thinking of some of the jokes in it. They're so inappropriate. I think the creative, imaginative kind of, it's all coming from the Kyoto. So it's that's one of the things about it. It almost feels like an auteur film in a weird way. It's it all kind of speaks to their kind of sensibilities
and their fixation. Yeah.
And if you watch some documentaries on them or some interviews with them and stuff, I mean, they pretty much got to put everything they wanted to put up there. Now I know I think the movie, the budget had was $2 million, and which is pretty low budget in 85, 86 when they made it. But
it's very low budget.
Yeah, they spent most of that money on the production because they did the special effects themselves, kind of like out of their own pocket. So they saved a lot of money on special effects because they were able to do the stuff themselves. So they were able to kind of give this film some production value, which I think is why it stands the test of time, because it still looks really nice. Not just on the Blu-ray, but I think even, and you know, I've always thought to myself, man, this movie looks a lot better than it has any right to look. It just looks good. John Vernon is, you're right. He is playing his, I hate kids, to the nth degree here.
He really, he pushes it.
he had this curmudgeon-y, performance. He's got it down. A lot of the best lines in the film though do come from Vernon. I mean, they come from him. He has some of the best lines in the movie. I'm going to see if I can pull up a couple here on the quotes. I can't remember. I don't know if I don't think I can do a John Vernon impersonation.
Friggies all.
There we go. There's one. Yeah. I don't see any quotes or any. Oh, here we go. Here we go. Look at this son of a bitch. He says that at some point. No, I don't see anything. I made it through.
Go on, Dave.
Yeah.
Make a dummy out of yourself.
Yeah.
He make a dummy out of me.
Yeah. He always
that's a
does.
Good one.
Yeah, he does always say Dave. I do. Dave. It's like you're like the inverse version of Hal the computer.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't Vernon weirdly feel almost, or doesn't Robert Lansing weirdly feel like the younger, more handsome brother of John Vernon in some ways? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Those shit heels, like pro shit heels.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Nice.
It's interesting. John Allen Nelson, who's in this film, he was in that movie Hunk and a couple other movies where he played the good looking, blonde headed beach kind of guy. And he's definitely got that look down. But man, his performance, if there's one drawback to this movie, the Dave character is so wound tight as a cop.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's unbelievable some of the line delivery he has that they would even leave that in there. It's so rough. And it seems to me like Grant Kramer's character only has like two or three lines of dialogue, and almost all of them involve the words, "Holy shit." He says that quite a few times.
Another door.
Another door. It's a Grant Kramer impersonation today. How about that? Holy shit.
You're only getting Vernon.
A lot transpires in this movie while Debbie's in the shower.
Oh, yes, yeah. That is the longest fucking shower possibly in the history of cinema.
Chagon took her away.
That is longer than anything in a women in prison film. It takes, holy fuck, she's really cleaning.
Yeah, she really is. I mean, she feels filthy, and that's probably from Todd's review of the film.
That cream pie.
Yeah, all these sight gags work in this. I think the sight gags are fun. The puppets, the silly guns, the cotton candy, the popcorn. They're all kind of fun. The big ball bouncing around with Debbie in it. It's all kind of fun. The ice cream truck. And, even the kaiju-inspired Clownzilla at the end, which there's a great forced perspective shot of Clownzilla coming down off that podium.
Yeah.
And it really looks good. I really like the way that looks, the way he comes off them stairs and stuff. Like, he gets bigger and bigger, and it's, like, really intimidating in a strange way. And then he kind of grabs that mock ice cream truck that doesn't sell ice cream but sells popsicles, which I'll go to my grave claiming that there's a difference. But the effects in the movie are the star here. I mean, that is really the star of the movie. Some of the acting is fine for what they're asking the guys to do.
It's functional. Yeah. It does its job.
Yes.
But it's not the important thing. The important thing is kind of the vibe of the movie and the effects, and the kills are fun. And it's just, it's one of those perfect films back in the day that you would rent and just kind of watch with everybody. Everybody kind of get together and, a great background movie. It's just one of those kind of things that, people sit around and watch, and it's all filler, all killer, no filler. It really, all filler. It's talking about Todd's review again. It's it is, there is a very little waste of time in the movie. I think it works wonderfully, and it's a testament to the Kyoto brothers that they pulled this thing off. Now, there's been rumors for years that they were going to make another one, and I know it's on IMDb is listed as they're going to make one in 3D, the Killer Clowns Return from Outer Space in 3D, or some kind of crazy thing like that. It would be interesting
Disney
to see.
Disney pulled the plug on that, though.
Yeah, because I think it was tied to Fox, right?
Yeah.
So Disney's definitely going to pull the plug. And which would be the case, because, I mean, my favorite scene in this movie, and this says a lot about Sammy, but the biker scene is one of my favorite scenes in any movie. First of all, there's a piece of graffiti on the back of the bar that says "No butt, no putt." I don't know what that means. That's a new one for me.
Well, clearly you're not versed in the butt golf.
Sammy's dynamic golf game. Well,
trust me. I know a thing. I know a thing or two about strokes and butt golf. But but no, the truth is, I just don't know what it's. Just, I freeze framed it. I was like, it says no butt, no putt. What does that mean? So maybe one of our listeners knows. But there is some other things up there, like
hole.
Yeah, kill them all, let God sort them out. Those kind of things are up there. But the biker scene's great. He's picking on the little clown. He tears up his bike. You're going to knock my block off, and then you get the Jason Takes Manhattan moment there.
Did you think that guy looked like Sonny Landham?
He did a little bit.
Yeah.
He looked like him a little bit, and that guy that's popular right now that played Hellboy, that David Harbour.
David Harbour.
Yeah, he looked a little bit like him, too.
And Meatloaf.
But there is a great, a little bit of Meatloaf there, yes. There's a great cut where they cut to the black character, and he says, "Shit," or he says something. Or he says, "Damn."
Yeah.
And it's so, like, 70s exploitation style cut. They knock his head off, and he goes, "Damn!" And they all run. It's a perfect scene. I'm just going to say it now. You know, everybody's got their favorite scenes. De Niro talking to himself in the mirror, Brando and the Godfather. I'm going to put that scene in Killer Clowns up there. It's an amazing scene of just strange cutting and bad humor and no butt, no putt on the wall. So. I need a shirt that says no butt, no putt.
Yeah, right.
I might regret that if I actually found out what it means. But
should be the next GGTMC shirt.
I wonder if it's a handkerchief thing or a bandana thing. Anyway, yes. But the movie is a lot of fun. Like I said, though, the acting from the John Allen Nelson character, Dave Hansen, a little rough. Not nearly as rough as the clerk at the drugstore. That might be the most... Yeah. I don't know what type of acting you call that.
Well, it doesn't help any that he's overdubbed.
That's my impersonation of
that. Tiny Tim having an orgasm.
That's right. That's my impersonation of that acting. I don't know what that is, but that's some type of acting he does. And then he calls the cops. He's like, I need help. It's like, what is going on? It's so strange. Anyway, they destroy that drugstore too. They milk it for all it's worth.
Oh yeah,
they destroy everything in that drugstore. Also, I like that when the clown comes up to buy his actual items. I saw some Scooby-Doo vitamins in there. That's you know, the Warner Brothers, I think, trying to capitalize on that Flintstone vitamin craze. But I remember those. I remember Flintstone. I remember Scooby-Doo vitamins. So a bit of a throwback. No, man, the movie works.
You guys keep talking for 1 second.
Yeah, the movie works and it continues to work. And I think the only explanation is it is all to the basic nature of the story. I mean, it really is. It doesn't try to do anything more than what it's doing.
Yes,
and because of that, it works. It doesn't. And I think the clown design helps. The music to the film helps. The John Massari, I think, is his name. Score. Mm. It works. The Dickies theme song is perfect for the movie. It's in a lot of ways, it's kind of the perfect horror comedy film. In a lot of ways.
I would say that it absolutely is. It's, you know, horror comedy is one of those things that's really tricky to pull off.
Sure it is.
And that's because of, you know, that whole laughing, screaming dynamic. And, you know, when you want to trigger it. So you're never, it's always kind of dicey. You're always kind of caught between, you know, which vibe am I going for right now? But I think that, you know, this film really does it well because it often gets both of them in there at the exact same time. And I think that that's kind of the trick to it, as you're supposed to be laughing, but you're supposed to be uneasily laughing.
Yes.
Because it's, you know, you're not meant to be laughing at this, but come on, admit it, it's fucking funny.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's the thing that a lot of these times that a lot of horror comedies don't get. They either go full on slapstick with just like, the window dressing, or they, you know, the opposite. Then, you know, they go for the, you know, the violence and the horror elements, and then kind of try to put a shitty joke on it, like a one-liner or something like that.
Yeah.
And I think I think that's the reason that the majority of them don't work, and that's the reason why this one does, is because they get it, they get how to merge the two of them, because these guys have been, you know, this is the way that they've been thinking, you know, since they were kids. So, you know, it really pays off here.
Exactly.
That's
and
my opinion.
And yeah, no, and I think it's a great example of a genre or a subgenre done perfectly, really, because the horror comedy is kind of a subgenre. But it's a kind of a great version of it done, you know, mostly perfectly. I mean, I can't say it's perfect, but it certainly attempts to be as perfect as can be, and it pulls off a hell of a lot of what it's doing. So it's very impressive. Still to this day, it's very impressive how this thing has turned out and how it's aged. It's aged incredibly well.
Yeah.
All right, that's all I got. You want to kick it over to you for Make or Breaks MVTs?
All righty. Make or Break. I'm going to go with the burger joint scene. Like I said, I mean, that's really the kind of moment that it kicks in, just how much of a threat these guys actually are. So it goes beyond, you know, simply being a weird little visual popsicle truck. driving around doing his thing. And MVT, I'm going to go with the Kyoto Brothers. How could you not? They are the authors of this thing. They are, you know, the passion, the love, the care that they put into this thing is it, every ounce of that is up on screen.
Yeah.
And you really do get the sense of just joy that they have in being able to do these things, being able to, you know, be magicians on film, so to speak. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And score for me, I'm going with... I know this sounds a little low ball, but I'm going to go 8 out of 10. It's still fantastic. Yeah. I still love it. I can't imagine anybody not loving this movie. So.
Yeah. Yeah. It'd be tough.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Will, you back for MVT's Make or Breaks?
Yeah, I'm on.
Yeah.
So Make or Break, I'm going to go with Mr. Vernon's scene at the police station. I think it balances, it kind of puts us, what am I going for here? So I think, you know, there's a lot of playful stuff and I think it's playful, but it's still unnerving. It balances that really well. MVT, the Kyoto Brothers, love and care that they put into this is just remarkable. Kudos to all that worked on this. And they created a timeless cult classic, which many have attempted and many have failed, but they've succeeded. My score is a 7.75 out of 10. I really love this film. It holds up wonderfully. The Blu-ray looks great. This is another week with another really colorful 80s film that Arrow's lovingly restored. High praise. This is a great gateway horror film for kids, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool.
My MVT is also the Kyoto Brothers. It's kind of hard not to be them, really. They did just about everything here. And it's really impressive what they pulled off. And really, kind of like Grismer, it's kind of a shame they haven't been able to do more stuff as far as directing and stuff. It really is a shame they haven't done more stuff. They made their stamp on a few things, but I'd like to see them, you know, make some more films and see what they could come up with. My make or break is the biker scene. Really love it. Again, no butt, no putt. Don't know. Don't know what it means, but it's got me morbidly curious. But it's a fun, goofy scene, and I think like all of us have talked about it, every scene that we've picked kind of encapsulates what this movie is. It's kind of like that perfect balance between the comedic and the horror, and they play it well, and it's very hard to do, but when you nail it, it's pretty amazing, and they nail it here. And with saying that, my score is also like Todd's. It's an 8 out of 10. I mean, I think. You know, for the 80s and everything else, I mean, this is a standout horror film.
Yes.
And it's a standout cult movie. There's no doubt about it.
And it's an original.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got a ridiculous title, and I think a lot of, if people have ever balked because of the title, don't, because I think you're missing out. This is a fun, incredibly fun movie. I can't say it enough. It's just, it's amazing how well this thing is held up. So, yeah. So, and I think I've bought it now three. Well, I didn't buy this version because I was given to it by Arrow, but I think I've bought the film twice. I bought it on DVD. I think I bought it on the original Blu-ray, and now I think the Arrow release. So, I wonder if I'll buy it again. I wonder if there'll be a 4K version if I'll buy it. Well, no, we'll see. I love it. You know, I watch. Seems like every 5 or 6 years I watch it. So, still works. All right, that is the big show. Yeah, we are done for the day. Got a lot of next week, Slumber Party Massacre, 1, 2, 3. Trillo GGTMC, going to have a little bit of fun. Should be interesting. Todd will bring out some of his more famous catchphrases for his review, like he did this week. Cream pies and whatnot.
Oh, yeah.
So that's, and Jeremy will be on. So looking forward to that. It's always fun to get a listener on. Is there anything else you guys want to add today? Anything you want to?
Nothing I could think of.
Yeah.
One thing I'd like to add, we got a very good friend, Dr. Zom, who's been waylaid with some back injuries, but some back pain as of late. Want to wish him a speedy recovery and lots of love from all of us.
Yes. Love that guy. He may not know it all the time, but he's a true gent to the bone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to the Bone Daddy.
To the Bone Daddy. No, he's a he's a good dude. Really is.
Yes.
Much love to you, Zom. Hope you get better soon. Yeah. I guess that is everything then. Support Arrow, support all that good stuff, and thank you for listening to the show, and I'll say adios.
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 Thanks for listening. You can find the gentleman at ggtmc.com, and you can email the gentleman at midnightcinema@gmail.com.